This is the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Jenny Beck-Esme, editor-in-chief of Feminem. I'm excited to bring you this next Fix 18 talk. It was maybe one of the talks that generated the most buzz in the room. It was a duo talk between two doctors, Dr. Tracy Sanson, who's an award-winning emergency physician and educator, a national and international speaker, and who serves as a core faculty member for the American College of Emergency Physicians, and Geeta Pensa, who's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Brown and an associate director for the Emergency Digital Health Innovation Center at Brown. She's also the host of the Academic Emergency Medicine Journal's Early Access podcast and a new MRAP contributor. These two fantastic speakers joined forces for a talk they called The L Word, a joint conversation about maintaining resilience in the face of pending litigation. This was a tear-jerking, thought-provoking, incredibly helpful talk to listen to about what it is like to be named in a lawsuit and how to deal with that as a doctor in our career. Sit down somewhere quiet and take a listen to this talk.
So I would like to take you way back to 2006. I realize that many of you were actually in grade school at the time, but I was, and attending in a community ED. I'd been working there for about 5 years, mostly nights, usually the only doctor in the hospital. One night, one fateful night, I take care of a 30-year-old woman. She's an engineer. I spend a lot of time with her and her husband trying to sort things out. It's a confusing presentation. I do a thorough and careful history and exam. I image her. I call a consultant. I wake them up in the middle of the night. I think about things some more. I go back and I re-examine her. I find her improved and wanting to go home. I wind up discharging her with a plan in place to see a specialist that morning, 3 hours from her discharge time at 9 a.m. She never makes it there. Instead, she goes home, goes to bed, and 1 hour later, suffers a massive cerebellar stroke. She's 30. Now, because she was taken to a tertiary care center after that, I had no idea that anything had happened until I was named in a lawsuit a few months later. It's proverbial, but hit with a ton of bricks sounds just about right. I was floored. I wanted to vomit when I read the complaint that detailed all the ways in which my negligence, my malpractice, had ruined my patient's life. She was permanently disabled after a prolonged ICU stay, and I alone was being held responsible. Nothing in my training had prepared me for that moment. I'd had lectures on defensive charting and high-risk cases, but not one word about what to do when the envelope was in your hand, when that finger was pointed directly at you. What did you do? How did you handle it? I had no idea. Everything in my general naive belief about the way the universe should work had made me think that if I was kind and thorough and careful and practiced good medicine, that everything would be okay. I did all of those things. And it happened anyway. In one moment, my professional persona was crushed, not only by the weight of the envelope in my hand, but the new knowledge that a young woman with her whole life ahead of her had put her faith in my abilities, her trust in my hands, and had suffered for it. How do you live with that? Turns out, not very well.
So what do you hear there?
What do you feel?
What are you feeling there? I feel pain. And I have FACEP behind my name, but I also have BTDT, been there, done that. The pain that you're hearing there is real. And we actually have a name for it. It's called Medical Malpractice Syndrome and Litigation Stress Syndrome. So we have our own syndrome named after us. What's the problem with this and how the hell did we get here? I want you to remember back to your first M&M. Anybody? Right, you can probably feel it. I remember I was at the University of Illinois. We would go over to Cook County and it was one of these theaters where you stood down in the middle. And what we were told, either implicitly or explicitly, was that if you'd just been smart enough, if you'd been more diligent, if you had been vigilant, if you had been whatever, this would not have happened. And so that's what we then take to our inside. And I didn't say this, actually Brené Brown did, but I'm gonna steal it from her. There are two questions that hold us back. They hold us back from reaching out for opportunities. They hold us back from taking those risks, but they also really crop up when we've got an obstacle like this. And they are, am I worthy and do I belong? And what happens is when you receive that notice of intent, and when you read where it says, Dr. Tracy Sanson willfully and wantonly deprived this family of their mother, wife, grandmother, all of a sudden it crashes down. And when we've been taught to be infallible and omnipotent, we really realize that what we are very fallible and incredibly vulnerable. And so what happens then is litigation stress. And we become angry and anxious, and insomnia creeps in, and an eating disorder, whatever it is, too much or too little. And then we have decreased concentration, and then our self-esteem and our self-confidence tanks, and depression kicks in. And what's wrong with all of those is it's eating us inside as both the human that we are and the physician that we are. And then, because of some of those things that we take on to numb that pain and the impact they have on us, some of which may come in a bottle called Stella, and some which may come in as a Hostess Ho-Ho and a Diet Coke, others may be distancing ourselves and maybe being a little more aloof with our patients or our colleagues, and what happens is a risk of a second case while you're trying to get your feet from the first is significant. So what we have to do is recognize there are certain things we can do, and we'll speak about those in a moment. But what I'd like to do for one moment is to recognize that what's key in all of this is an intense feeling of isolation. I'm alone. Nobody else could possibly be this slow, stupid, dumb, or whatever it was. No one else could possibly feel like I'm feeling. And because all of us don't know what to do, we treat that person almost as if they have cooties. I'm not going anywhere near them because I don't want my own case. And we become isolated. But the fact is that 10% of us a year will be sued. I can't see because of the lights here. But I want anybody here who's received a subpoena, a notice of intent, a suit has gone all the way through a suit, to put your hand up in the air. You are not alone, and so the idea of isolation must be squelched, and that's one of the things we're going to do up here.
So it was textbook litigation stress, malpractice stress. My suffering, wondering why I just couldn't deal. Sleeplessness, weight loss, tears on the way into my shifts alone in my car. I hated going to work. And at the same time, I couldn't imagine not being a doctor. It was such a part of who I was. At home, I was impatient with my children, ballistic with my spouse. Every lawyer's correspondence brought a flood of negativity that lasted for days. And that was the thing, this never seemed to end. Every time I thought I'd gained some ground, found some footing, there would be a new ruling, something else to review, something would arrive at my house and just send me into a tailspin. The weeks turned into months. The months turned into years. Series of legal events knocked me flat in succession, one after another. Attempts at mediation failed. Settlement offers were rejected. My anxiety and my physical symptoms continued to mount. I had never had a history of anxiety or depression before in my life, but I became a person who needed multiple meds just to stay upright, just to put one foot in front of another, to barely function at home and at work. I was a chess piece in what was, to everyone else, a $28 million game of strategy. That was their ask in the end, was $28 million. I had seen this play out before. I had read front page news about giant verdicts against physicians in my state, publicly naming them, shaming them, calling out their incompetence. I could not bear the thought of it.
So what do you do? Well, let's start with the first one. That's breathe. Because when it first comes, that's about all you do. You breathe. And then you take the next breath, and then the next breath, and then you're good for a minute, and then maybe you're good for a couple more minutes, and then an hour, and then a week, or a month, or a year goes by. What's the average length of a case nowadays? 3, 5, 7, who knows? Here's the problem with that. When you're irritable and insomnia, and have an insomnia, and no libido, and fatigue, incredible fatigue. I'm not talking regular life fatigue or mama fatigue. I'm talking cannot get out of bed to do obligations that you know need to be done fatigue. Do you think that your relationships, your significant others, make it through 3 to 5 to 7 years of that? And so what happens is we need to figure out, where do we go from there? How do we build? Well, it has to come from you. It's self-care. How many of you have a primary care physician? Get one. How many of you have had that stress test or those things that need to be done? Is it your masseters or is that your angina? Is this just your dyspepsia or your penetrating ulcers? How many of you actually have a hobby? Now, I'll ask this question. How many have a hobby? And everybody's, well, yeah, I have a hobby. And unless it's attending conferences, how many of you have done that? In the last day, year, month. I mean, I used to say, I do photography. And then it dawned on me, my camera had not worked for over 6 years. So what do we do? Breathe. Do not think that you can remain uninvolved. Who we are control mongers. We have exaggerated senses of responsibility. That's why and how we do well, but then we have a problem with this. So remain engaged. Go to those things. Engage with your lawyer. Remain involved. Work moving forward. And I'll let you finish the story, and then we'll fill it with a couple more tips.
That was supposed to be a surprise. I don't know where that came from yet, but I guess I'll just leave it up there because this is the part where I get to actually be happy again. You knew it was coming. I did indeed go on trial in 2011. It lasted for 4 weeks. There were four horrible, miserable weeks. I did win. It was a very, very hollow victory. I returned to work, still hating it, totally miserable, but not able to really find the will to change anything. Misery loves inertia. And then I got the notice of the plaintiff's intent to appeal. I had no idea that that was even a possibility, and I was starting from the lowest of the low, all over again. The nightmare, as it truly was, started. Weeks turned into months, months turned into years, and in 2015, the state Supreme Court overturned my verdict. I was going back to trial. I felt like Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games when they sent her back to the quarter quell. Incredibly unfair. And I also did not think that I would survive. I begged my insurance company to settle, find some way to settle, or I wouldn't. They wanted me to fight, and I didn't have it in me anymore. Until one day, after a particularly emotional phone call with my attorney, I hung up the phone, and in a fit of tears, of racking great sobs, which I had become very acquainted with, I decided. I had that moment that I had heard about, but had never expected to come. And I want to pause for a moment and concentrate on this minute, this decision. I had a Scarlett O'Hara moment where I declared that I would fight, but with God as my witness, I would never be like this again. And I want you to understand that at some point in your life, you will be faced with some chronic affliction, a condition, substance abuse or depression. You may come to a point where you realize you still have enough insight to see that you are in really big trouble, but just enough hope left to think that you might be able to get your old self back if only you try. But you have to change something to do it. And that changing is the most difficult part, or at least it was for me. The first step is admitting you have a problem, right? Well, 10 years in, I realized I had a problem. And I didn't know how to solve it. And for the first time, I started looking for outside help. First, I got books. I read books. Self-help books. Never got them before. Books on litigation stress. I read them. I made notes on the margins. I tried mindfully the hokey exercises that they said would help. Who knew? They actually did. And then I started talking. I started asking my friends for help. I started being more open and honest and forthright about what was happening. And I talked to a very gifted psychologist who made me understand the value of therapy for the first time in my life. I learned a few important things. One, as Tracy said, we are not alone. We are all in our little silos of suffering. But there is a way out. At the individual level, yes, we can learn about coping mechanisms and strategies. We can learn about litigation, and we should, about the mechanics and how to perform as a witness. All of these things that we don't do in medicine, but they're learnable, typical skills, and we should be doing a better job with that. But also, it's time for a culture change. Those feelings of isolation and helplessness and shame can be mitigated by a culture of openness that destigmatizes this process. If we are all going through this, how could we possibly all be bad doctors? So, my raft of bitches, it is time for a culture change. So what happened to me? Well, I started making very conscious decisions, being mindful about my decisions. I actually started to view the lawsuit as something that gave me permission to start taking care of myself. I am being sued, it sucks, and so I deserve X. And yes, X often was chocolate, but it also was decisions that benefited my happiness, my family's happiness. I started to look for the love in what I did again. I started small. I read a poignant essay about the spiritual satisfaction of taking care of the lowliest of our patients. Society's forgotten. I cut that out. I carried it around with me. I started small. I looked for the love. And then, when that spark came back, I made bigger changes. After 13 years in community medicine, I joined an academic faculty at Brown. I see some of you out there. I started learning new skills like blogging and podcasting. Yes, podcasting is awesome. I started teaching. Now, the lawsuit was all before. But also things that I learned to learn. It was something that I learned to manage. And to end on
this little happy note.
Okay. Did I take this off? Am I good?
No.
All right. Okay. All right. So to end on this little happy surprise. I did get better. It was a long slog. And in the months approaching my second trial, I had enough insight to realize that I needed some positive distraction. And a friend of mine sent me an email about an annual charity ballroom dance competition for doctors, which is actually kind of a big deal in our state. It's a little state. And I had thought for years that sounded kind of fun, but definitely not for me. And I was about to delete it, and then I noticed the date of the gala was exactly 1 week before the start of my second multi-million dollar trial. And I thought, this would probably be good for me. And I filled out the form, and I sat for a while with my finger on that send button. And then in a moment of calculated craziness, I pushed the button and thought, oh my God, what did I just do? And then I realized, you know what? I am on a mission. And then I was in it to win it. I shook everybody that I knew down for money. That's for the free clinic. I practiced my steps with a professional ballroom dancer. For 4 months, I committed to this. And then, 1 week before trial started, the night of the gala, in front of literally 1,000 guests, not to mention it being live streamed on the internet, I won that mirror ball trophy. Having in the process raised myself over $25,000 for our free clinic. And 1 week later, I walked into that courthouse with my head held high, anxious, but okay. I had prepared and practiced for this role too. And although much of it was out of my control, I was ready. The same people who had come to the gala came to trial.
A third of our ED staff who had been at the gala red carpet ready, totally lit, lined the benches of the courthouse, silently cheering me on a second time and reminding me that our relationships are the things that will save us in the end, reminding me of how I was truly blessed after everything. I testified for hours, for days, like a boss. I invited my residents to come, to watch, to learn. And in the end, after 3.5 weeks of trial, I won a second time. I had wanted to model grace under pressure for my children who were now teenagers. Remember, this was 12 years. They grew up in the shadow of litigation in their house all of their lives. But I can tell you, I am okay. I am not the same as I was, but I can make a really good argument that I am stronger for it. And what I know is that my career is so much more than any one case. And so is yours. Thank you.
I got mine back. I get the final 3 minutes. So what do you take from this? I want you to start collecting anytime somebody says something nice to you. Anytime somebody sends cookies to the emergency department, which you didn't get anyway, somebody ate them, but they left the card. I want you to take that card. When a patient says to you, do you have an office? You know how pathetic we are. We're like, whoa, they like me. That email, you need to have those files so when this occurs, you can go back and look at that. You need to have that failure friend so that you can call them. Because what we need to do is figure out what can we learn from it. There's something you can learn from every one of these. And I think there's two things to take from this. One is the incredible importance of relationships and how we let those go. We do. We get caught up, especially once significant others and kids and stuff start coming in. So I'm going to challenge you. I think we need 12 people in our lives at a minimum. The first three are people you look up to. You emulate them. You read their books. You go to their conferences. You follow them on podcasts, whatever it may be. The next three, and I want you to listen carefully, are people who would die for you. Notice I didn't say you'd die for them. Because most of us would die for our kids, right? And in most cases, our significant other. And the third, next three, so you look up to, would die for you, your tribe. Anybody else done this? And I know, you've called them with that ugly cry, that ugly snot dripping, hitting the floor cry. And while you're on the phone with them, you get this perception like, what are you doing? They're like, okay, I'm done. I made a reservation. I can be there by 9:15 tomorrow. Your tribe. And then who's your last three? The people you're bringing up behind you. Who are you mentoring? Who are you developing? Who are you helping through something like this? And then when and if something like this occurs, I want you to take all the lessons you've learned. I want you to pick up your new bad self. And then close that door, it's over, and move on. And then what I want you to do is stand there or dance there and say to yourself and everybody around you, I am growing up from my ashes. Thank you.